Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Welcome to Connecting Faith. We are seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, which means that as we are surveying the headline news and as we are encountering the complicated realities of modern day life, we pause and we think about what we're thinking about and we consider what the biblical principles are that we might bring to bear on a situation. We consider that we are the ambassadors of Christ in this generation. We take seriously the mandate of God to be authentic, reliable representatives representing Christ and God's view to the world around us. So if you are engaged in the conversation to the day and you're sitting back thinking to yourself, wow, these people are really missing the God point here. They're really missing the connecting point in terms of the way they are talking about this particular issue or the way that they're talking about people or the way that they're seeing things. Well, the longer you sit back, the more sort of coals you're heaping on your own head, because here's the deal. You're in that conversation on purpose for God's purpose. So God actually wants you to be the person who opens their mouth and says, hey, you know what? I have a little bit different perspective. Grows out of my understanding of who God is and how he sees things. And so here's my take on what you guys are talking about. Now, we've been talking all week about immigration, and we are going to continue that conversation in part today in a conversation with Jenny Lang from World Relief. Specifically today, we're going to talk about refugees and the unique challenges that they face both around the world and then here in the United States. But starting off, we're going to do what we always do, which is the headline news of the day. So I don't know about you, but it is summertime where I live, which means kids are out of school. I think that will definitely be true pretty much for everybody by next week. And so it didn't take long for me to recognize that I needed to go to Amazon and order some books for summer reading, because it only takes, well, I got one at home who read her assigned summer reading like the first day she was out of school. So I clearly needed more. And I thought to myself, you know, where am I going to go for a reliable list of books for my kids to read this summer? And just in time, as if in anticipation of my asking the question, Justin Taylor posted a blog on the Gospel Coalition. So if you've never been to their website, it's thegospelcoalition.org. And today, there's a blog posted there called Summer Reading. Actually, I should read the actual title instead of just the little thing here on my notes. Summer Reading, a grade-by-grade recommended reading list for kids. So what are they going to read this summer, and how are you going to know that it is good? Like, that's really the question. How are you going to know that it's good? These are going to be good books that are going to, teach the kinds of values or at least represent the kinds of values that you have. So Justin put this list together in cooperation with a classical school, which is a classical Christian school. Actually, this one happens to be in Hampton, Virginia. And they gave Justin permission to reproduce their list so that grade by grade, parents would have somewhere to go, or grandparents have somewhere to go, and get books for this summer that that'll be healthy and wholesome for your kids to read. So there you go. It's posted at thegospelcoalition.org, and it's a grade-by-grade summer reading list for your kids based on a classical Christian school curriculum. Okay, the next story that I want to do today actually comes from the New York Times. And I actually had a conversation on Twitter today about this particular article. It was a back and forth with a couple of other folks. But the article is, let me just tell you, nothing short of disturbing. And it may not be something that is topping the headline news where you are, but my guess is that if you read this article, you're going to say to yourself, wow, do I know some people that could have been or might have been caught up in this kind of very, very tragic situation. So here's the headline. They shared drugs. Someone died. Does that make them killers? prosecutors are increasingly treating overdose deaths as homicides. But they aren't just going after dealers. Friends, family, and fellow users are now going to prison. And so as I read the article, which, by the way, is the dateline is Hibbing, Minnesota. And there's a story that actually is from a family in Hibbing. But these stories range from West Virginia to Florida to Minnesota and elsewhere across the country, where people who have been either present with a person who overdosed or woke up to an overdosed individual, they are being criminally prosecuted in those deaths. And in some cases, these people call 911. In some cases, they actually administer the sort of anti-overdose reversal medication. Well, there's a couple of different names. Naloxone is one of the names that it goes by. And so these are people that they're going to prison. And so I think that we are now at the stage of the game where we are asking of our criminal justice system to do things that it is simply not designed to do. And as you read this kind of article and you consider the horrendous toll that overdose deaths are costing us as a country, you know, we need to be thinking about personal responsibility, but we also need to be thinking about what it means to be our brother's keeper. Yes, there are sins of omission, failing to do something that you might do, and then there are active sins of commission, where you are perpetrating an act against yourself or another person. There's the conversation about the intervention that God requires of us to be the Good Samaritan. And then there's the reality of benign neglect. If I fail to do something, am I criminally responsible? So the issue, according to attorneys who weighed in on the Twitter conversation, the issue is really intentional reckless action. So when you think about intentional reckless action, you're talking about something that turns out very badly, and if you had thought about it before you did it, you might have come to the conclusion that it was reckless. So intentional reckless action are things like texting while driving and driving under the influence. And so if you are involved in an accident and you are texting while driving, you're involved in an accident while you are under the influence, you could also be criminally prosecuted under these intentional reckless action laws. And so that's what we're talking about here. So the reason that I bring this up is I think we have to get to the place where we recognize that there are things available to us, drugs being topping the list, but our smartphone that is sometimes smarter than we are when we're driving and we are tempted to use it, the mixing of, let's say, smoking pot and driving a car. Okay, so you will be driving under the influence in that particular case. We actually know we're not supposed to be doing those things, and yet sometimes we do them. And so that is intentional reckless action. And I'm lifting this up today because I suspect there's a lot of us doing things that could be judged by the law to be intentionally reckless. And so I want to bring some biblical principles to bear on this conversation, because there's one line from this article that really got me thinking. Here's the line. The cost of prosecution and incarceration would have been better spent, some say, on addiction treatment, which the family could then not afford. Quote, it's kind of like blaming the leaves on the tree, you know? This is what Mr. Malcolm, who is quoted in the New York Times article, says. He says, what about the roots? What about the roots? And I think that is a good entry point for Christians into this conversation. What about the roots? We do reap what we sow. Our fruits do bear witness to our roots. By its fruits, you will know them. Galatians 5 gives us a litany of bad fruits and good fruits that are produced by what? Well, produced by what we're rooted and grounded in. And so Jesus teaches, you know, on the vine and the branches and the fruits and what happens when the Father, you know, isn't getting what the Father wants from the produce of our lives. And there's also a conversation here about justice. And certainly justice is imperfect when we're here, but there is ultimate justice in heaven. And there certainly will be a judgment day. And Judgment Day is another sort of headline topper in the news today. So before I run away from this one New York Times article, I just really commend to you a very, very frank conversation, particularly with younger people, about the choices that they're making and the potential negative impact those choices have on those around them, and that the law is no longer here in America just holding people responsible for their own activity. They're actually holding you responsible when something bad happens to somebody around you. And that's a significant conversation, I think, to have with young people, because, you know, they'll say, well, I'm making these choices, and if it hurts somebody, it only hurts me. And I think we are now at the stage of the game in our society where we can say to them, you know what, it doesn't just hurt you. First of all, it hurts me as a person who loves you. But it also potentially hurts those around you, and you can actually be held responsible for their bad decisions and their bad actions. So anyway, that's the stage we have reached in our culture. On the subject of Judgment Day, let me just lift up this one, you know, clearly headline news story of the day. Harvey Weinstein has arrived at his own Judgment Day. You can literally read the coverage. It's ubiquitous across every media platform today. But it does give us a conversation starter, or a way into a conversation about Judgment Day. Anyone who is using that language is actually using eschatological language from one of the three Abrahamic religions, all of which view history as eschatological, that there will be a judgment day. If you wanted to look at the Bible, you could look at Daniel, Isaiah, Revelation, certainly the teachings of Jesus. You could talk about the wide and the narrow way from Matthew 7 or Luke 13. You could talk about the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25. And I think that... I think that also on the Harvey Weinstein front, when we talk about Judgment Day and we talk about, you know, the reality that nothing that is currently hidden is going to remain hidden forever. Nothing that's concealed. This is Jesus in chapter 8 of Luke. Nothing that is concealed will fail to be known. It will all be brought into the open, and it will all be brought to the light. So it's a good reminder today. Also, a reminder today that we're praying for the referendum in Ireland, praying that the unborn will continue to retain their rights, and that the referendum to remove the Eighth Amendment from the Irish Constitution related to abortion, we're praying that the referendum would fail, although it sounds like in exit polling that it may well pass. So we're going to continue to pray on that front. All right, friends, I'm going to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to be joined by Jenny Yang. She's the Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief. She's also the co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. We've got updated copies of this book, a brand new edition. It's not being released until July, but we've got copies to give away today. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We'll be right back. Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Indeed, we are talking about what it's going to be like when the kingdom comes, when people of every tribe and nation and tongue find themselves populating together the kingdom of heaven as brothers and sisters in Christ, one family, unified. And yet here on earth, we don't yet live in that reality, but we are, as Christians, seeking to bear constant witness to the reality of the kingdom of heaven, even in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And so we've been talking this week about immigration, and we've been talking about how we, as Christians in this particular culture, can bear positive and effective witness in the immigration, migration, and refugee conversations taking place in our culture. And so joining me today is Jenny Yang. You can follow her on Twitter at Jenny Yang WR. That WR is for World Relief, because Jenny is the Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief, where she provides oversight for all advocacy initiatives and policy positions, representing World Relief's advocacy's priorities to the U.S. government and mobilizing churches in advocacy campaigns. She's also the co-author of a book we have to give away today. It's called Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. It's a revised and expanded edition. It's not even out yet, but we have a couple of copies to give away today. You can call me at 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Jenny, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So you are... you are really the expert of the week in terms of the folks that we've had on to talk about these issues. I mean, among everybody we've talked to, you are really the expert in relationship to refugees. And that is the one subject mm-hmm. that we haven't really talked a lot about, the special case of refugees. So if you will, start with a basic definition. Who or what is a refugee?
Sure. Well, a refugee is anyone who has to meet the definition of fleeing a well-founded fear of persecution. So you have to basically leave your country and go to another country, and you have to be forcibly displaced, which means that you have to be fleeing persecution based on your race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. And so if you are fleeing an earthquake, you're not considered a refugee. If you're fleeing some kind of natural disaster or general economic poverty, you're not considered a refugee. And so estimated right now, there's around 22 million refugees. So individuals who, again, have crossed an international border are finding themselves in another country and are fleeing specific persecution. And so right now, we are actually facing the world's worst refugee crisis since World War II. And we know right after World War II, there were significant numbers of people displaced, pretty much concentrated in Europe. And what we're seeing right now is that there's a significant number of people, 22 million, like I mentioned, who are fleeing persecution in Africa and in Asia and in parts of Latin America. And so this is a global humanitarian crisis in which we're facing, in which we've worked with a lot of churches to respond in concrete ways.
Okay, Jenny. So there are 22 million refugees globally right now. Who made up that definition? And then who sort of manages refugee resettlement in terms of, like, who goes where to what foreign country to be resettled?
Sure. So most refugees in the world, the 22 million, are, well, the definition, let's start off there. Pretty much right after World War II, the United Nations felt like it needed to define individuals who are fleeing specific conflict as a way for the global for the global community to respond to these specific individuals. And so they felt like this group was specifically in need of protection because they were not fleeing poverty. Their lives were literally in danger, that they were fleeing literally to save their lives. They could not stay at home. And so the legal definition was established by the UN, but the United States also adopted this definition. It's laid out in the Refugee Act of 1980. And so we follow a similar vein where someone has to have a well-founded fear of persecution. Now, of the 22 million around the world, most refugees are actually going to flee immediately to the surrounding neighboring country. And so, for example, in the Middle East, most Syrian refugees are now in Lebanon and in Jordan and in Turkey. And then you have places, for example, in Africa, where a lot of Britain refugees, for example, fled to Tanzania, or the Rohingya refugees right now in East Asia. A lot of them are fleeing Burma into the neighboring country of Bangladesh. And it's really important to remember that most of the refugees that are fleeing are going to stay in these neighboring countries. So, for example, in Jordan, about 20% of their population is made up of refugees. And in places in Africa, many of these refugees live in refugee camps for, on average, about 17 years. And so depending on their home country and whether or not there's peace or not, many of the refugees will remain refugees for a long period of time. And so what you see around the world really actually is that refugees are not necessarily going in significant numbers to Europe and the United States. The developing countries, the ones that are lower to middle income countries, are the ones that are actually bearing the responsibility of hosting these refugees. And so right now, I think there's a lot of attention to what's happening in Europe and the United States. But I think it's important to remember that when you look at the global picture, those numbers are still pretty small compared to the fact that these neighboring countries are actually the ones hosting the world's refugees. And when it comes to U.S. resettlement specifically, we're talking really about a program that's run by the State Department that's really used as a foreign policy tool, in which our State Department identifies specific groups of refugees they think cannot go back home or locally integrate, and for whom resettlement would actually change the lives and the trajectory of these individuals. And so the U.S. resettles less than half of 1% of the world's refugees. So this past year, we resettled around 50,000 refugees. Before that, we resettled close to around 85,000 refugees. And again, even though that may seem like a large number, in terms of the global resettlement numbers, that still is a very small percentage of the world's refugees. And so refugee resettlement is a very targeted response to identify some of the most vulnerable refugees, and that's how the refugees are able to be able to come into the United States.
Okay, you anticipated my next question, which was how many refugees does the United States agree to receive? Because I do think that we're seeing, at least according to a New York Times article that I read recently, you know, the numbers have plummeted in terms of how many refugees we're actually actively receiving. So I want to talk about that process, because I think that people likely don't know the kind of process that a person goes through in order to be resettled in the United States.
Sure. And I think it's really important. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about refugees, because a refugee cannot just show up at the border. Again, they are selected by our State Department. They have to go through a vetting process, which normally takes on average a year and a half to 2 years. And it's only after they pass the security screening and then they go through medical checks and are sponsored by a family or a relative or an agency like World Relief, are they then able to come into the United States of America. So if you have a refugee who's from Syria that's living in Jordan, they're not going to be able to raise their hand and say, I want to go to the United States. It's a process that starts on our end from our government, and they're the ones that actually ultimately make the decision. And so when you actually look at the history of the refugee resettlement program, it was actually in response to what was happening around the world. So in the early 1980s, which really formalized the U.S. refugee admissions program, you had President Ronald Reagan, who admitted under his administration the largest number of refugees in a single year. There was nearly 200,000 refugees that were resettled in the early 1980s, and most of them were coming from Indochina, from Vietnam. And so many of the Vietnamese immigrants and people, families that you meet in the U.S., have some kind of refugee background. And it was really a way for Ronald Reagan to say that we're not afraid of these individuals that are the victims of communism. And it was a way for him to promulgate democracy around the world, to say these are the individuals who are suffering under a communist regime, but now are going to be welcomed and thriving in a democracy. And so back in the 1980s, you saw hundreds of thousands of refugees coming in. And then in the late 1980s, early 1990s, we started resettling refugees from the former Soviet Union. And then in the mid-1990s, a lot of refugees from Africa. And then I would say in the past 10 years or so, we started resettling a lot of refugees from the Middle East, even a lot of persecuted religious minorities that were Christians and were being persecuted because of their faith and were coming into the United States of America.
Let's pause there, because we got to take a quick break, but we're going to continue the conversation when we come back. Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. My conversation partner is Jenny Yang. We're talking immigration today. Specifically, we're talking refugees. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. Stay right with us. We'll be right back. If you can take, hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. My guest today is Jenny Yang, immigration expert and co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. We've got a new edition. It's not being released till July, but we've actually got copies to give away today. You can call the studio line at 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. This is a great resource for you and your church, for any group of people that wants to get together and understand the history of immigration in our country, understand what the Bible has to say about it, and understand how you, can advocate on behalf of new immigrants and on behalf of comprehensive immigration reform. So Jenny, again, thank you for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Carmen. Thanks so much.
So let's do a little more on the myths and misconceptions about refugees. What are some things that we don't know about refugees that we need to know?
Sure. I think there's a couple things. I think one of the most common misconceptions that I hear is people say, well, don't you see what's happening in Europe? They're getting a flood of refugees. And what makes Europe so different than the United States as a reason for us to basically close the door on refugees in the U.S.? And I think it's important to understand that the European system is dramatically different than the U.S. system. It's completely like comparing apples and oranges, because in Europe, what's happening is many of the refugees that are coming from the Middle East are literally getting into boats or walking on foot and literally crossing borders and crossing the ocean to get to the European Union. And they're not vetted beforehand. They're basically arriving and seeking asylum. And actually, it's only when they get there are they applying for asylum and then being vetted as for national security reasons. In the U.S., we do have asylum seekers that are coming at the border, but when we talk specifically about refugees and the refugee resettlement program, these are all individuals who have been selected and vetted before they even land foot in the United States of America. And every year the president signs a determination that says we cannot exceed this number. Right now that number is 45,000 refugees, which right now we're even on track to resettle half of that number, so about 20,000 are likely to come this year. And so that process of what Europe is going through and what the U.S. is going through is completely different. Just geographically speaking, we're not experiencing what Europe is experiencing. I think the other thing to understand is I know there's a lot of fear around Muslims in the U.S. and just what it's going to mean if we start accepting Muslim refugees. And I think, especially for us as Christians, I feel like we have to have a missional mindset when it comes to welcoming the stranger. Understanding that the U.S. accepts the most vulnerable refugees, and that Muslims in the U.S. make up less than 1% of the entire population of our country. I think anytime we interact with people of a different faith or different religion, I think it's an opportunity to share the gospel with them and an opportunity to build relationships with people that are different than us. And at World of Belief, we've partnered with thousands of churches over the many years to equip them to respond in practical ways to their neighbors. And some of the most transformational relationships we've seen is actually when church volunteers and advocates enter into relationships with refugees who are of a different faith and who are of a different background, because you learn so much about what God is doing around the world. And it's also an opportunity to share the gospel as well. So I think on those two fronts, again, I think thinking missionally and also understanding that we're also, again, just referring to a small number of people is really important for people to understand.
Absolutely. And I think you guys have a resource, like a downloadable ebook, sort of the 8 things that people need to know about refugees but may not know. Where would listeners go to get that?
Sure. So at World Belief, our mission is to empower the local church to serve the most vulnerable. And so if you look actually on our main website, worldbelief.org, there's a lot of resources on there, including the guide that you were talking about 8 specific things people, church leaders should know around refugees. So that can actually be found on our website at worldbelief.org. And also on our website, we just have a lot of other resources of how your church can respond, either through just education or giving and just basic facts and myths around refugees and immigrants. And so, again, I think as an organization, we're here to equip pastors and volunteers and others just to be able to respond in a tangible way to the folks that are right in your own communities.
So, Jenny, one of the things that I really loved about the book, and we had Matthew Sorens, your co-author, on yesterday, and let me remind my listeners, I've got a few copies to give away. So if you want a copy of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, the revised and expanded edition, you can give me a call at 877-93-FAITH or email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. One of the things I love about the book is it's like written to me. Like it's just written, mm-hmm. It's written like from you and Matthew to people like you and Matthew who may have started at a very different place in this conversation than you ended up. And you sort of take that journey yourselves and you let us all see what that looks like. And then you talk about what the journey ahead might look like for all of us as we engage in these conversations in our culture, but do so from an authentically or distinctly Christian perspective. And so what I'd love for us to spend a couple of minutes doing is like, really addressing sort of just how negative the views have become in this country, particularly in relationship to refugees. I know you're familiar with the new Pew research that literally just came out, I think, yesterday, where, you know, it's talking about just how negative Republicans in particular have become toward refugees, even as the number of refugees being admitted is plummeting. Can you just talk with us about how public perception has changed or is changing and how we might positively impact that?
Yeah, well, I think in that Pew Research Center survey, it wasn't just Republicans that were not thinking that we should accept refugees, but specifically a white evangelical, the 25% were the group that was the least likely of all the groups that were interviewed to think that the U.S. has any responsibility to accept refugees. And I think that's a startling statistic, because what this survey also found is that the reason why they're thinking this way is not based on their faith or their theology, but it's actually based on their partisanship and ideology. And I think that's the challenge we have today, is that I think so many times when we think about issues like immigration or refugees, we think about it primarily through the lens of our political party or maybe economic or social concerns, but we oftentimes don't ground that response in what is a theology around migration or what even the scripture would teach us around how we're to respond as a church. And so I think it is troubling, because I think what it speaks to is the fact that sometimes our partisanship or allegiance to, party or a certain kind of politics trumps maybe what we believe about the Bible or are being informed by the Bible. And so I think there's a gap there. And I think what we, church leaders in particular, but organizations like World of Life and others, can really do to challenge people to view this as an opportunity for discipleship and for loving our neighbors as Jesus commanded us to do. And so I think right now the challenge is, how do we grow deeper as a faith community to apply the lens of our faith to hot topics like immigration, and especially understanding the work that God is doing in a broader framework and engaging in that kind of missional work. So, I think, you know, whenever we have partisanship or ideology drive our response, as this survey is indicating, I think we're starting to lose our way as disciples of Jesus. But I think when we really can go back to the Bible and have that inform our response, that's a better way to go.
Okay, and I love that that's what your book does. So again, thank you for writing it, in addition to thank you for doing what you do every day. What for you specifically, what is your hope for reform of our current process, and then how can listeners get equipped and engaged?
Sure. So right now, the president actually has the authority to determine the numbers of refugees that are coming in. The 45,000 that is set for this fiscal year has been the lowest that's ever been set in our country's, in our nation's history since 1980. And like I mentioned, Ronald Reagan was the president that admitted the most refugees per year during his administration. And so I think especially World Refugee Day is actually coming up on June 20th. And June 20th, there's going to be a lot of activities that different groups are doing to rally support for refugees around the world and in the United States of America. And so I think for Christians in particular, it's an important opportunity for us to continue to raise our voice, to speak out to our elected officials and let them know that we want to continue to be a welcoming country for refugees, and not have that statistic of 25% define us, but to actually say, no, we're one of the people of faith that are saying we should be welcoming of refugees, and then letting our voice translate into concrete policy decisions. And so I think members of Congress work with the White House to determine that number, the 45,000. And at World Relief, we've been saying that number should be higher. It should be around 75,000, which is more in line with historic norms. And so contacting your elected official is definitely one concrete way you can continue to support refugees coming into the United States. The other thing is World Relief has 20 different U.S. offices around the country, where we are resettling refugees, even though the numbers are lower. We're always looking for volunteers. And so if you look at worldrelief.org, you can find a map of where we have all of our offices, and it'd be great for folks to volunteer and get to know refugees themselves. And specifically, if you're a pastor, you know, it's so important to talk about this within the church. And so even preaching a sermon on immigration and refugees, or hosting a missions week or weekend that's focused specifically on this topic of migration is really important. You mentioned, or we mentioned earlier, 8 things you should know about refugees. The specific URL for that is worldbelief.org/8things, the number 8 and things. So again, it's worldbelief.org/8things. And of course, we would love for listeners to donate just to our ministry, because many of our staff were actually former missionaries that were overseas and are now serving immigrants and refugees in the U.S. Just to be bicultural. And so even donating to support our ministry, because we settle refugees, but we also serve many refugees overseas. So we work through local churches in Jordan and in Kenya and even in Indonesia to serve migrants that are living there. And so those are just a couple things that your listeners can do to engage with refugees.
Okay, so I'm on the worldrelief.org website right now. And folks who are listening to us in the Twin Cities area, you have a World Relief office right where you are. And our folk, our listeners in Wisconsin, you have a World Relief office in the Fox Valley. And those of you who are listening elsewhere across the U.S., there are World Relief offices in all kinds of places, including Atlanta, Georgia, Memphis, Tennessee, Akron, Ohio. The list is pretty long. And so I would really encourage you, if this is a conversation that you've said to yourself, all right, I didn't really quite get or understand how I'm going to engage on the illegal immigrant conversation, I get how I could engage on the refugee conversation. I get how we're talking about, you know, people fleeing persecution. I get the need for resettlement. I get that these people who are coming forever, and they're going to be my neighbor. And so you can learn how to engage with them. I know at my local church where I go to church, one of the things that they just periodically put in the bulletin are, you know, places in our wider community where refugees are being resettled. And then we're just really encouraged to just go to those places and just start getting to know people. Like, you can, you know, it's amazing how many, I live in Middle Tennessee, and it's amazing how many Christian brothers and sisters from Egypt who are Coptic have been resettled here. And we now have 7 Coptic churches here in Middle Tennessee. And so it's really fun to engage and learn about, you know, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, because that's kind of, you know, new to me. You get to celebrate the High Holy Days twice if you celebrate at your own church and then you celebrate with them. So just all kinds of ideas of engagement. And we are talking about, in many cases, we're talking about Christians from other parts of the world. And so if that's something you're particularly interested in, you know, I'd encourage you to go to worldrelief.org and get equipped, particularly on the refugee resettlement front. Jenny Yang, it's been absolutely a delight to talk with you. Thank you again for the new book. Friends, it's called Welcoming the Stranger, a revised and expanded edition. And we've got a few copies available if you want to call 877-93-FAITH or you want to email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us on Connecting Faith.
Great. Thank you so much, Carmen, for having me.
Absolutely. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When I come back, I'm taking your calls. I would love to know what you're thinking about, what your reaction is, what your questions are. Could be anything immigration related, could be about refugees. I'll do my best. We'll engage in a conversation that hopefully is edifying to Christ and edifying to his church. The number here is 877-93-FAITH. This is Carmen LaBurge on Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. That must be this is our last opportunity to get some music in on a Friday afternoon.
It could be.
Crazy contribution from Ted. Ted, thanks, man.
Happy Friday.
Okay, so I am taking your calls. The phone lines are open. Let me apologize to those of you who called yesterday, and I misunderstood the cues that I was getting on the board, and so I responded to you, but I never brought you on air. And today, the phone lines are actually open. You get to talk on air if you want to. It's 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. I have a listener who has emailed me, This is an excellent question. Thank you for lifting it up, Lynn. Lynn is a new listener. So first of all, welcome. Welcome to the listening family here at Faith Radio. And I can tell you right off the bat, I have not surveyed anybody. So my immediate answer to the "have you surveyed any churches" question is going to be no. But I think that your larger question is, all right, what has been the experience of churches who have engaged in refugee assistance efforts in the past? And you are right in noting that not every experience that's cross-cultural, where we're bringing people from one culture into another culture, that process of assimilation can be messy. And I think, as in all situations, sometimes there are individuals who, because we're all sinners, do things that are bad, criminally bad. And so one of the things that Lynn notes in her email is, you know, am I aware that there was a worker from a Roseville, Minnesota church who was sexually assaulted by a refugee back in the 1980s? I'm sure that's actually not a totally isolated incident. I'm sure there are stories. And so part of what we want to remember to do is that we have to safeguard ourselves. I would never have an individual woman working in any capacity with an individual man. Like, let's just not do that. Particularly when we're talking about assimilation, particularly when we're talking about cultures from which people come who might absolutely be have a very different view of women, let's say. Let's just start there, okay? So I do think that teaching the American way of thinking about a lot of things is a part of the assimilation process. So, Lynn, thank you so much for that question. It's absolutely a good one. Hey, Guy from Goodrich, North Dakota, I think you called yesterday and I didn't bring you on, so thank you so much for calling back today. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. In the last 5 minutes of yesterday's show, you responded to people who say that immigrants, illegal or otherwise, need to, quote, get in line or just be part of the process. And you responded by saying there is, quote, no line and there is, quote, no process. But as you know, many immigrants become legal citizens in this country every year after going through years of the process, standing in lines, and jumping through hoops. And as you just previously stated, there are many Coptic Christian churches. So obviously,
those
migrants
are
getting
here,
and they're in the process and in the line. But you're less than truthful is the issue, the point I'm making. And that's
kind of a problem for me.
It's Christian radio.
Okay, wait. No. Oh, I think Guy hung up before I could answer.
No, I think I'm here.
Okay, we got a weird dial tone. Okay, Guy, so this is where I think is such a complex issue. There are absolutely people becoming naturalized citizens of the United States of America. What the distinction that we're trying to draw, and we've been painstakingly trying to draw all week, is the difference between legal immigrants, who you're talking about, legal immigrants who actually, or legal refugees who go through the process of naturalization and become United States citizens. Absolutely. We celebrate that. That is awesome. The conversation that we were trying to have in the part where we talk about there's not actually a line for them to get in, those are people who are already here with no documentation. So the conversation about there's no line to get in is the conversation about, let's say, we hear them called dreamers. Okay, so they were brought here as children. And they've been here. This is the only country they've ever known. There's currently no line for them to get in through which they could become a naturalized citizen of the United States. And so you are absolutely right. We have an immigration process through which people can legally immigrate to the United States. We do not currently have a process for the people who are here illegally. And the reality is, Guy, we're not going to deport 11 million people. So what are we going to do? That's the question that I would like for us to be finding an answer to.
Yeah, first of all, I think our first priority as Christians should be to legal citizens. For example, hundreds of thousands of children in foster care, millions of homeless people, all of whom are currently citizens. We don't have unlimited resources as the church as a whole. we must prioritize. And okay, those
so
who are actually following.
Can I ask a question related to that? Because I have dedicated lots of programming time to the issue of foster care and adoption. That is absolutely one of my very serious heartbeats. There's no question about that. So when we talk about our current laws related to people who are here and who are undocumented, we're actually deporting parents and therefore creating a greater problem in relationship to foster care and therefore adoption here in the United States. We're actually breaking up families right now through our immigration enforcement. And so this is, it's not, there's nothing clean and easy about this. We need secure borders. We need comprehensive immigration reform. And yes, we need ministries that are related to the homeless. We need ministries that are related to adoption and foster care. We need ministries that are related to opioids.
Can I respond?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I fundamentally disagree, because if you look at what has really caused this problem, and it really exploded exponentially after the first so-called amnesty passed by the Reagan administration and Congress at that time, and that's when the floodgates opened, because illegals out of country thought, well, gee, I guess we come and
so
illegally
what year,
stay.
Then so what year did that happen?
Eventually. Please, please let me finish.
Just tell me what
it's
year it was.
Kind of misplaced compassion, which really incentivizes crime and causing people to come. How many people have died crossing deserts and oceans because we've given them this false hope that coming here illegally is going to result in citizenship?
Guy, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your input. Thank you so much. I'm not sure if my family crossed the ocean illegally, but I know that they certainly risked life and labor in order to get here to this fine nation of the United States of America. So what we are trying to do is be people who allow the Bible to inform us, and where our views are not in conformity with what God has revealed to be the principles of the kingdom of heaven, it's our responsibility as Christians to actually bear witness to the kingdom principles of heaven here in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And so part of our challenge is going to be that we don't always represent an answer that that aligns with what is going to be, the easiest answer to the question or the most obvious answer to the question, and certainly not the simplistic answer to the question. So I absolutely appreciate Guy lifting up all of the issues that he has surfaced. I think those are the questions that people are asking. I think people tend to view immigrants of every variety as a threat, as if there are not enough resources here in the United States. And so let me remind those of you who, in particular, who are pro-life. If Roe v. Wade had not gone the way that it went at the Supreme Court, there would be 60 million more Americans in the United States right now. And so when we talk about resources and we talk about, you know, we don't have enough resources in school or we don't have enough jobs, we think as pro-life people, we're actually 60 million people short. And if we're 60 million people short and there's 11 million people who are here and working without documentation, you know, is it possible that we need some of them in order to do what some of the 60 million who we've killed off are not here to do? Like, these are the kinds of complex conversations Christians have to engage in. And we're not going to become, as Christians, people who are defensive against everyone else in the world. We're not going to become xenophobic. We're not going to be afraid of people of other religions, because people of other religions are the ones who provide us opportunities for evangelism. And so you and I, it is incumbent upon us to develop a biblical Christian worldview on the most complicated issues of our day, and then to enter into those conversations and seek to bring the truth to bear, even when it's really, really difficult. All right, folks, thanks for the feedback. Guy, in particular, thank you for the robust conversation. I'd encourage you all to engage these issues. WorldRelief.org is a good place to go. If you want a copy of Welcoming the Stranger, you can still let me know, Carmen@MyFaithRadio.com. That's all we got time for this week. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend. God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.